heart and says his prayers by night, may become a wolf when the wolfbane blooms and the autumn moon is bright. Hello and welcome to Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other changeable people as masterpieces. I am Nick, the victim of a cursed bloodline, and I am joined as ever by Roger. How do you do? We are cranking out the Wolfbane and looking at the full moon because we are going to do a few episodes on werewolves, having touched on vampires recently. So we're going to start right back, not at the very first werewolf movie, but probably the most successful.
Okay, so I'm not sure anybody can say for certain what the actual first werewolf film was. I can tell you the first feature-length werewolf film.
Is that Werewolf of London? Or
yeah, 1935, which is Stuart Walker directing Henry Hull, the great Warner Oland. But it's missing a vital thing, and that vital thing is what comes along in The Wolfman, 1941.
Yes. What's the vital thing it's missing?
A German immigrant. Specifically Kurt Siodmak.
Okay.
Who basically fought for this film and, to a lesser extent, its sequel, basically invented most of what people currently think of as ancient werewolf lore.
Okay, so, I mean, there is a history of lycanthropy and people who thought they were wolves, but a lot of the stuff we see in The Wolfman then is Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, it also ties over, bearing in mind we're talking primitive concepts of mental health here, but it also ties over to the original meaning of lunacy, which was something, a madness that seemed to be moon-dependent.
Yes.
So.
It also, of course, has a gypsy curse.
Oh, is it? I mean, it's a curse that has fallen on gypsies, but that's not quite the same thing.
Okay, fair point. So this is one of the few, well, maybe not the few, a universal horror film. This is after Dracula and Frankenstein, presumably.
Mm-hmm.
But it is the one, not the one, but maybe the first one that doesn't have a kind of literary pedigree. Unlike those two.
Yeah.
I guess we then had the mummy and the creature from the black.
The mummy, I don't think, was based on a novel.
No, I don't think so. So, but the Wolfman was, yes, entirely invented, but based on legend. So, but these were mostly made up.
A crucial thing, let's not forget, from Siodmak's point of view, is he didn't have to pay anybody else royalties. Unlike Dracula, Frankenstein.
Well, I guess they weren't out of copyright by the time the Universal films were made, were they?
And these days, of course, Universal makes a firm claim on the copyright of all these things.
Oh, isn't copyright law a wonderful thing? So, the story, such as it is that we have a returning... supposedly son of Claude Rains, who's about twice the size of Claude Rains,
he's
American.
Described in many summaries as estranged, and there's a bit of dialogue supporting it, but they don't, they never deal with, you know, why he left or anything like that.
No, but he's coming back because
his brother
has died. By he, we are talking about Lon Chaney, in the film that would basically set him up for the rest of his life, or at least typecast him for the rest of his life.
Yeah, a bit. I mean, he was definitely typecast as a horror actor. He definitely got roles other than this, than werewolf.
But they were mainly lurching monsters of the night. Here's the one where he gets to be a bit human as well, because in fact most human, because we don't see a lot of him in his transformed form. But he is, we have, basically the film opens with him arriving at the hall in, English small village. I'm not sure if we know exactly where it is.
It's described as a village. I'll come back to that point later.
It's more of a town, that's fair enough. It's somewhere in the home counties, presumably. And we have, returning Ribbon of Memes alumnus, Claude Rains. I'm sorry to say, I think Claude Rains is really phoning it in here. Now, Claude Rains phoning it in is still Claude Rains, and I love him, but he doesn't, to me, he's just reading the script in a Claude Rains way. That's my take of it.
I have an alternative explanation, and I'm definitely not saying that I'm right and you're wrong, but I think possibly one thing they might have been trying for is that he is more the reserved British guy. As we see with the Doctor and the policeman later.
Well,
whereas, by contrast with Lon Chaney, who is George Lon Chaney Jr., brash American type.
Yes, fair point. But I do feel when I've seen Claude Rains in other roles, there's always been a sort of a twinkle or a joy. I agree.
I mean, he's not the same character. Prince John Olredo. I will absolutely agree with you there.
Hawley Griffin in The Invisible Man. I mean, you don't even see him, but he's got a twinkle in his eye as The Invisible Man. Anyway, that aside, he does a solid supporting job.
He's a very useless father, let's face it. He presumably knows at least some of this stuff, and he never. Anyway,
he doesn't warn his son, and spoilers for all of these films, by the way. But he does beat his son to death at the end, so that's also problematic. Though to be fair, he doesn't know he's doing it. Lon Chaney goes. We have the creepiest. Maybe this has just aged badly. It certainly has, but I feel even in 1940, his pursuit of the love interest, Gwen. Yes. So first of all, he has a telescope room in his hall, and
it is his father's telescope.
But
he has been working in some sort of engineering job in the States, and he has brought a lens which his father wants.
And like all technology throughout history, he immediately uses it for pornographic purposes as he owns the telescope on a young lady's room in the village.
I was looking at some other reviews of this, and several of them say that he accidentally spies on her. No, he deliberately points the telescope down into the town, and the first thing he sees is a young lady, and he sticks with that. Thank you very much. That's not an accident.
There's no accident there. And then he tracks down the shop, goes in, and then reveals his voyeurism to her in a way that he expects her to say, "Wow, you're quite a sex bomb." She says,
"No." My note scene while watching this is that works on women, does it? Really?
Maybe it does, but I mean, she says no quite firmly. He, being a young white guy in the 1940s, doesn't take no for an answer, or doesn't even assume that no is even a possibility. He's set his sights on her. She's going out with him. And she's kind of resigned to this after a while. But
one of the things about this, which I think we'll come back to, is that there is not a lot of subtlety in the acting. I mean, one could read it from the script as though she is resigned, as you said, or one could read it as she would like one last fling before she gets married, as we later discover she is engaged to be married.
Well, I think it's fair to say that Lon Chaney Jr. doesn't have the widest range.
Absolutely.
Of acting.
I've got to say, it doesn't help me. Last time I saw this, which was many years ago, I didn't have the visual reference, but now I can't help thinking he has that same sort of build as the Cray twins, that very solid face and head.
Yes, he's not kind of classic leading man material, but he's also not very kind of facially interesting particularly. Anyway, they go on a date. They go to the fair.
With Gwen's friend, Deb Neat.
yes, Deb Neat. They have a lovely time going to a fortune teller who proceeds to tell Lon Chaney Jr.'s character that he's about to die. He's about to get cursed. She sees a pentagram on his hand.
At this point, it's only Deb Neat who goes to the fortune teller.
Oh, yes. And she's about to die, but she doesn't mention that to her. Because, you know, even fortune tellers have ethical constraints.
No, sorry, I can't give you a reading. And also, please wear this bulletproof plate over your chest.
Yes. The whole wallet, please. You won't be needing that for too much longer.
And it's sad to see, really. This is Bela Lugosi. He still had a bit of a career at this point, but he was... He was prescribed the morphine and the methadone. The alcohol he added himself, but he is definitely on his way down. No, this is not total career collapse, but, you know, a few years, I think it's about time, this point he signed up with Monogram and they just put him in every old piece of crap with the small lines so that they could just say, and with Bela Lugosi.
Yeah, we saw the sad end to his career with Plan 9 from Outer Space some mm-hmm. years later, during which he died before the film. I can't remember. And then they used footage, Edward, bless him, he used footage from an entirely different film and is there. His orthodontist, I think, mm-hmm. who looked nothing like Bela Lugosi. You're right, yeah, I mean, there isn't a lot to his role here, and I agree. It's sad to see that.
But what we do get from this is the vision of the pentagram on Dead Meat's palm.
Yes.
And I wondered, you know, we've got this thing about, you know, the left hand is the one that predicts the future, or the right hand is the one that predicts the past, or possibly the other. Does this swap over if you're left-handed?
Apparently it does. I've looked into this once, and it does, I think.
How about ambidextrous? So
well, then you live in both the future and past simultaneously. I know it's because I am left-handed. I think I was told this once, but they wanted to look at my left hand for whatever purposes they usually look at the right hand. Anyway, doesn't go well for Dead Meat as she's murderized.
Yes, her escorting party wandered off into the woods to canoodle. I mean, to have a serious conversation about how she's going to get married soon, honest.
Isn't that a bit... I mean, I don't know. It's hard to feel... I'm going to be... It's
but by the mores like... of the time, she should be having nothing to do with this obviously interested bloke. Or indeed any bloke without an escort. She should be sticking with her female friend.
So I find this interesting. You know, this is at the height of the Motion Picture Association Code.
The early days, but it's definitely in force, yeah.
Oh, yes, exactly. It's they're not messing around with it. And I do feel this is playing at the edges, really, isn't it? They're doing their very best to say she's sleeping around, but, I mean, they can't say much more than they do, other than she's about to be engaged and yet she's interested in another man, which is interesting. I mean, because a lot of werewolf lore from this point, whether it was before, it is about, I guess, repressed sexuality and mm-hmm. Beasts within and a puberty as well, maybe. We touched a bit on that with the Lost Boys and there, but I think you're right, didn't quite fit there. I'm not sure it fits with the films we're looking at, but certainly a lot of the films we're going to talk about, it's about repressed, or not so repressed when we get to the 80s, sexuality. So yeah. I think it is a deliberate choice that they're playing at the edges here. I agree with you that the nuances that you need for that, you know, that people like Bogart were so good at and... You know, you could really get across what they were trying to say here, but the nuances in the acting just aren't here to tell you to read between the lines.
Yeah. The other thing is, I have seen this calls forward a bit. I've seen more modern analyses that basically say it is his wolfishness that makes him vulnerable to the transformation. But I don't think the film supports that because A, it's 1941, and by the standards of masculinity at the time, he's not that out of order. I mean, people would toss at him, but they wouldn't say you're a bad man for doing this.
He aggressively pursues a woman, but I agree, I'm not sure that is particularly unusual for a white male in this kind of era.
Particularly an American coming to repressed England by the concepts of the time. But also, we've got that rhyme. And it seems to me that what that rhyme is about is it doesn't matter how good a guy you are going to lose control to the beast.
Well, I think that's it. This is an interesting thing with the Wolfman, as opposed to like our previous Dracula and Frankenstein. They are just forces of evil, basically, or Dracula particularly is a force of evil. Frankenstein, the book isn't, but I guess in the film, at least, it's well, even there. But it's... You know, there is good and there is evil and you're on one side or the other. But here, you're just bad luck. You're a werewolf. It's just something that happens to you.
You've caught the disease and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yes. And also, the evil is within you. It is you. And a lot of the werewolf stories are kind of tragic in that sense, that they are people trying to fight against this beast within. So it's an interesting, different take on horror as opposed to you're going to this haunted house. It's like, actually, you're the horror. That most werewolf stories, or at least this one, does dwell on the kind of the... And this is why I think Lon Chaney Jr. is perhaps not the guy for it. I know it was his famous one. You really need to be able to sell that kind of inner turmoil, and I'm not sure he's got the acting chops for it.
We should mention that he buys a stick with a significant silver handle.
That is quite a chunky handle, isn't it? You could beat a whale to death with it. But yes, it's a huge silver handle. It must cost a fair bit, but I suppose he's quite well to do, so he does all right.
What we end up with is Dead Meat gets attacked and left dead. He and Gwen hear the scream and rush to assist, and I think they get separated. I think he rushes to assist.
Yes.
In any case, they're separated. He finds the wolf and beats the wolf to death with his stick.
Without breaking the stick. I mean, that's quite an impressive
feat. To be fair, a good walking stick should be quite capable of that.
Okay. Okay. But yes, he manages it. But in the process, he is scratched or bitten on the chest.
Yeah, anyway, which injured. I'd just like to say, it's quite hard with conventional jaws to bite a flat thing.
That's what I was thinking. You have to be, like, either side of it, presumably. Otherwise, it's just going to be a really nasty pinch at the front.
But... Yeah, I mean, you can bite a handheld out flat, for example, fair enough. But with a chest, you could get scratches, sure. But...
When we actually see the wolfman, he is the wolfman. He's very much, in my terms, brachycephalic, and he has a very short nose, as opposed to the more typical dolichocephalic, very long-nosed creatures that we often see in werewolf fiction. But the wolf that he's fighting is basically a wolf, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I mean, it's not clear whether this might be a progressive thing or... to some extent under control, or, I mean, we just don't have enough information.
We don't have a lot, no. But it turns out that was poor old Bela Lugosi, who was beaten to death.
And we have a sensitivity note, obviously. We are aware that the term gypsy is not a term we would use in the modern day.
Yes, because we're talking about
the Roma, but in terms of the film, frankly, it is much more cinematic gypsy than it is anything to do with actual Roms, so...
Well, that's it. We might as well say gypsy because, as you say, their relationship to actual Romani peoples is limited.
But anyway, the other one we meet is the old woman Maleva. Now, this is a really interesting bit of acting because this is the great Maria Uspenskaya, who was a revered acting teacher for many years in the States.
Oh,
but it turns out being a revered acting teacher does not actually keep your acting school open necessarily. So she did, I think, about 5 or maybe 10 films, basically to get funds for the school, and this is one of them.
Okay. Well, she's very good in the role she has to do, which is a...
Oh, yeah. She is the professional actor in this film, frankly.
Her and Claude Rains, but yeah. She's trying, at least.
Well, they have one scene together, but...
Yeah, she's got what has become a stereotypical role, this wise old woman who is, you know, knows more about the world than you do with all your science and materialism. She knows the deeper legends and the truths behind it.
And while it's not clear just how much Bela knew, she certainly knows everything.
Yes. He's not too aware. Anyway, yes, she knows everything. She knows he's going to turn into a wolf. And she tells him she will. Now, is this tied in with the full moon in The Wolfman? I wasn't 100% sure.
No,
it was.
That was actually invented in 1943's Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, also written by Sienkiewicz. Okay. It is, in fact, a direct sequel to this.
Yes, poor old Wolfie never got his own, like, Wolfman 2. He was in a lot of other Abbott and Costello.
Universal loved combining the things.
Well, it's basically their version
the Wolfman's
of the Marvel.
A draw. Frankenstein's a draw. We'll have a film with both.
Precursor to the Wolfman, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I guess.
I won't speak here of Jesse James Meets Frankenstein's Daughter, except, oh boy.
Well, when you're getting to Abbott and Costello, actually some of the Abbott and Costello meets were quite good, and so his wound heals. He staggers back, to the hall. He is in trouble with the law now because he's beaten a man to death, and the police
come
knocking.
He's left these stick wounds on the body.
We'll
come back to that.
Well, then, where do we go from there?
Then we have the concerned ladies of the town.
Oh yes.
What are you doing hanging around this nice young lady? Be off with you.
Especially if she's to get married. All right. Then we have the fiance
who turning up. If you look at his Wikipedia picture, he is one of the people that Terry Thomas was parodying. So.
Okay, wonderful. Yes, Patrick Knowles in a basically upper class asshole mode, as opposed to upper class patriarch that Claude Rains is doing.
Ralph Bellamy is the police chief, the colonel.
Oh, lovely Ralph Bellamy. again, doesn't get much to do. The wound heals, and Lon
remarkably quickly.
Then we get a transformation scene fairly shortly afterwards. And one of the, I'm going to mention the transformation scenes because it's one of the things people go to the cinema to see is the transformation scene from man to wolf. Here particularly though, I have to say.
Well, I don't think this was the first time it was done. But it was certainly one of the big things that people made a fuss about at the time. So it was at least somewhat innovative.
When was Jekyll and Hyde? Because that was a really classic.
Which one?
Transformation. The 30s, I think it was 30s or 40s. But that transformation scene is regarded as one of the greatest in cinema, because they changed the lighting. So I just wonder if it was before this or after this. But he had different makeup depending on which filters they put through. So,
my goodness, so many films. There was a 31 film which was widely praised, and there was a 41 remake with Spencer Tracy and Ingrid Bergman.
I think I'm thinking of the 31. We'll have to maybe revisit it at some point. But yeah, I'm pretty sure it's the 1931 transformation scene. So it was already a thing sort of people were looking for. Here we get some large rubber boots with yak hair stuck on them. I don't want to describe, I mean, for the time, not the boots, but the kind of, we never see him transform into a wolf, I think. We see him transform out of one later on.
And it avoids having I think a version that had been done previously would basically, we will just stop the camera, apply another swatch of fur, and start the camera again.
Yes, I think they may do that in reverse this time. But then we see Lon kind of loping through the woods. I don't know if it's just time or how parody it is or something. I mean, it just does nothing for me, creepiness or scariness. Why? It's just kind of dry ice, woods, and a man in a very clear...
At the time. To modernise, it's very obviously studio woods rather than location woods.
Absolutely. The werewolf, I know we're not expecting much from 41, 42, but we're going to talk about the film in a minute.
The actual makeup's pretty good, I feel.
Well, I guess so. I mean, if you wanted to do a man who is half wolf, yeah. But it also, to me, looks faintly ridiculous. I just don't. And that his, again, with Lon Chaney, I know he's this icon of horror, but he just sort of, there's nothing particularly canine about his movement, is there? There's nothing particularly lupine about the way he just kind of lopes about. I'm unimpressed with his, as unimpressed with his lupine acting as I am with his Homo sapiens acting.
There are questions of anatomy here, and you obviously have spent a lot more time around dogs than I have. But in terms of the bone structure. Now, you look at the leg of a dog, and it appears to have this backward-pointing knee, and anatomically speaking, that is the heel.
Yes,
and then the
tarsus.
The pad of the foot is what, for us, is the front of the foot. So, effectively, they're walking on something like tiptoe all the time. The upper leg is much shorter and isn't obviously a separate thing unless you start looking quite closely. Well, there are two things here. A, it's not terribly well suited for balancing as a biped.
I have seen some dogs walk as bipeds, yeah, but they have to be specially trained. And yes, they don't go very quickly or very easily.
I mean, just as humans can tiptoe, but they do not typically do it all the time.
Yes.
But also, I got distracted by this, I must admit. Maybe audiences at the time wouldn't have been, but I just feel, no, I mean, I know how a dog walks. And, all right, you can't portray him walking the way a dog walks, but you've shown this really nice detailed paw. So how does it work? Ag. My problem more than the film's problem, perhaps.
Well, I think it does sort of come naturally from the fact that in a way, I'm less bothered by it here than maybe in some of the other films, because he is so obviously a man who's had fur applied to him. But
that's another thing, because the traditional werewolf is, insofar as there is one, is you transform into a wolf.
Yeah, you're not halfway, you're literally a wolf.
And I don't know how deliberate it is, it may have been a limitation of the makeup, but this is definitely, we are not saying you are now a wolf, we are saying you are now this weird hybrid thing.
Yes, exactly. It doesn't work for me. It's probably, I mean, ultimately.
Oh, yeah, Maleva gave him an amulet. Let's not forget.
Oh, is that what makes him only half? Oh, yes, yes,
no,
that's his import.
Because he promptly gives it away to the girl.
Yes, yes. Well, he's a gallant sex pest. So that's nice.
Yeah, she's not at risk of transforming. Yet.
Okay. So.
I do find it slightly odd because presumably Bela had the amulet before. And presumably he wasn't murdering people everywhere he went. So why did it trigger this time?
Good point.
Was it in her palm? Yeah, we don't know.
I keep sounding hesitant because I'll be honest that the plot keeps fading into the background of my mind from this point.
Let's get on with the action. Longini claimed a lot of things about how painful the makeup was and how, you know, the crew would just leave him to take a break in mid-application and all this kind of
and
thing.
And kind of nailed him to the table.
Many of these things do not appear to actually to have been true.
Or at least not supported by the filming logs, which say he took a 2-hour lunch break or whatever, along with everyone else.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, so we have the church. Yeah, let's not forget this, because this is why I say village, because that's an awful lot of church for a village.
Yes, something of a cathedral, in fact.
It's not an actual church, it is another studio set. It may well have been a set that they had handy from something else, we don't know. But it's definitely a big church, like Canterbury Cathedral, rather than...
It's quite an impressive one. Yes, we have the villagers getting concerned, because he's killed a peasant? A villager at at this point.
She's only an extra.
Another dead meat. It triggers a hunting party. They set out bear traps or wolf traps. Those traps that you step on and they have jaws and they snap closed. Snap closed on his leg and he's a bit stuck. Wolves will generally chew their own legs off in this sort of situation, so I don't know... I would have liked to have seen that scene, but he doesn't do that.
We've already established he's sufficiently bestial that he has forgotten how chains work, which puts him well below most dogs I've met.
he is met by a kindly passing, well, not kindly passing, but again, cinematic gypsy, who Maleva has the power to sort of transform him back into a human.
Maybe.
And anyway, he's now a human with a bear trap on his leg. But that would normally break your leg, presumably. But he has got superhuman powers of healing, so he's just hobbling a bit.
Yeah, I mean, he is in this transformed form, which is larger than either man or wolf. Mm. So that might have greater resilience as well. Yeah, actual wolf is lighter than an actual human, and obviously the legs are smaller because there are four of them. But shrug.
It's fine.
I did note down there is a certain sheerly practical reason for while people are hunting in the woods with rifles and shotguns and things, you probably don't want to run through the woods in the dark
or split up. But yeah, it's Well, this is the early days of hunting. Well, it's not the early days of hunting at all.
No, it really isn't. But in the end, how does it work out? The girl has gone out looking for him, possibly.
Yes, doesn't he? He's about to leave town and he looks at a palm and he sees the pentagram, so he knows he's going to kill her next or something.
And, but in any case, he is about to kill her, and then his father turns up and beats the wolf to death with the stick that he gave him earlier.
Now we're not given any indication that Claude Rains is a badass. He's just kind of an elderly gent, not elderly, but of the standards of the time. He's in his 50s, which I suppose isn't elderly now, I think fairly.
But shut up.
He's capable of besting a werewolf quite easily, particularly a young, healthy, strong werewolf.
Although we don't see it, I think one could justify that by doing the version where silver actually is a painful burn rather than just this is the weapon that works and others don't.
Yes, but that would be fair. It would have been nice to have some kind of slight... The wolf pauses a bit or something because it realises it's his dad, but this isn't that kind of nuanced film, really.
In any case, by the end of it, we have dad with the body of his son beaten to death with this very distinctive stick that he is holding. In other words, the same position his son was in earlier.
Yeah. I'm sure it'll be fine.
But he's a more respected chap. I mean, he's probably a magistrate himself, so it'll be fine.
It probably will be fine. He's landed gentry, so it'll be all right for him. I've been a bit disparaged about this film, which is a bit harsh, because it did a lot of the first things that werewolf films did. It just feels very... I guess what I associate, perhaps unfairly, with the Universal horror films, in that they're just kind of... They're not really very scary and they're very sanitized and they're very superficial. And I don't know, I perhaps being unfair, I won't go on about Lon Chaney's acting again, but I just feel the acting of it felt phoned in. I do feel it's interesting, you know, as a horror film, this one's one that happens in an English village, rather than up in Carpathia or, you know,
well, yes.
Somewhere different.
But I'm not sure how much one can read into that on the basis that remembering Dracula, which I think is reasonable to regard as at least strongly influential, if not foundational, to modern horror,
yes,
is all about the horror is coming home to nice, safe England.
Yeah, the less good second
as well
part
as horrible things happen overseas.
Does that happen in the Universal film? I think that's mostly up in Romania.
Yeah.
Oh, it does. Okay. I need to revisit the old Universe films.
Well, it's never a bad time to do that.
Well, that's true. I enjoyed it.
I'm not going to disagree with you on your criticism of this, or indeed with my own. But I think where Siodmak really shows his worth as a scriptwriter is that he realises he's got basically stock actors. He hasn't got room to establish more than stock characters. And he writes a script that keeps the action moving. And you know, if that's a problem, well, too bad, you can paper over it. Because something exciting has happened.
I think that's fair. I'm not disparaging the script at all, which I think does a lot of interesting and new at the time things. I think the execution just feels a little too, old Hollywood. Don't get me wrong, I think we both feel we prefer black and white. If a film is black and white and old Hollywood, kind of, we're already quite well disposed to it. So that is not a milieu I dislike. But it just felt a bit too safe. I just felt like there was horror here that could have been plumbed. Now, you could argue maybe it's too early for that, except we're about to discuss a film from a year later that does it way better, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. So shall we just summarise and say... I think we both enjoyed it, but definitely not a masterpiece.
It's hard to say not a masterpiece because it is such a classic overfilm.
I mean, it might get in on the influential argument it certainly was.
But I think it's just not, I think I am rather meanly not making it a masterpiece. I enjoyed, but I would certainly watch it again. You know, it's very watchable.
I'm feeling very positive about it. Certainly, I mean, I will probably watch it again reasonably soon. I've seen it before at least twice.
We're just trying to judge it, or I at least am trying to judge it by the standards that we judge other films by, and by that, yes, influential, definitely, and created werewolf lore, but I think the execution, to me, means that it isn't a masterpiece. And that really came home to me when...
Well, let's just say, in closing, other films we have reviewed from 1941, Citizen Kane, The Maltese Falcon.
Okay, so, you know, you can do... Subtlety and Genius, and as indeed you can do in 1942, because the next film we are discussing is Cat People. Now, it's a bit of a cheat, spoiler, it's not a werewolf film, but it is a lycanthropy film, and I think we're allowed to have it.
Yes.
I'm glad we're allowed to have it, because it's great. But we'll come, I mean, I have seen this once long ago, and enjoyed it then, but I enjoyed it thoroughly this time. So, I mean, this is a kind of similar setup, but there's a lot of different changes. One is that we are set in, at the time, modern day New York, which straight away gives it a very different feel, very different atmosphere from the Universal horror films. It's using sets from the Magnificent Ambersons, I think, and the director, had he just come off the Magnificent Ambersons? Oh no, because that would be, it was Orson Welles the director of Ambersons? I think he wasn't allowed to be after, that was supposed to be his second complete creative freedom film, but they decided giving complete creative freedom was a terrible idea to Orson Welles. I don't think he ever had it again, or not for a long time. Anyway, Cat People is a French director, Jacques Tourneur.
Yep.
Tourneur. And it is, again, in some ways we have a similar American protagonist, very confusingly called Oliver Reed, which absolutely confused me. So Oliver Reed is the character name, even though Oliver Reed has his own werewolf film later on as an actor. Anyway, this is not that Oliver Reed. The character is called Oliver Reed, played by, oh, what's his name? He's very bland, isn't he? So I can't remember.
Kent Smith. As I noted down, he's made entirely of wood.
I mean, even his name is entirely forgettable. He needs to be, in a way, so I'm not complaining. I've been very disparaging about Lon Chaney's acting. I wouldn't say Kent Smith does a lot more, but I do think he's better. But he approaches a woman at a zoo, and it, again, doesn't really take no for an answer from her. There seems to be a bit of a theme developing here.
Yeah, though, again, I don't think this is meant to be... I think we're meant to be more or less in sympathy with him, at least to start with.
Yes, we are, and I think his approach is less bullish, I guess, than Lon Chaney Jr.'s. He is at least got some charm to him, which I feel was somewhat missing from Lon Chaney Jr.'s performance.
There's a scene later which undoes that thoroughly for me. But
okay.
Shall we talk about the production first? Because this is basically RKO sees that Universal is making money off these horror films, and they seem to be fairly cheap. So, right, well, we want some as well. So they put Val Lewton onto it. Basically, they put him in charge of the department, and he can then recruit the people he likes with the minimal budget available.
Right.
And Jacques Tourneur was one of the people he pulled in. They did quite a few. I think it may have been seven. Not all with the same crew, but basically he got in a whole bunch of people he knew were solid and reliable.
Okay,
lot of reshoots, that kind of thing.
This was the first one off that batch.
Yes. And I think, to be fair, probably the best known.
The others were things like I Walked with a Zombie and other more obscure films, I suspect. Yes, okay.
But anyway, so Tourneur has done, he's done a few things, some in French, but nothing super well known at any rate. I mean, Nick Carter, Master Detective, probably tells you all you need to know about that film.
Oh, I want to see it now. I bet it's terrible, but it sounds great.
So, yeah, and he meets this woman who is clearly a bit unconventional. Mm. I mean, she invites him up to her apartment on their first meeting.
Yes, she's of Eastern European origin.
Specifically Serbian.
And she's working as a fashion designer.
Fashion artist, I think. Basically, right. she's doing the sketches rather than being allowed actually to design stuff. It's a fairly menial role.
And this is Simone Simon. Actually
French.
Yes, and that is sufficiently foreign for Hollywood audiences. But she is doing a kind of Serbian. She doesn't come across as entirely French. She feels like a Eastern European performer to me.
Compared with everybody else in the film, she is blatantly not American, which is frankly all that's really needed. But
you cannot. What I also I kind of get the allure of her. You know, she's. Mm. I mean, she's not the. Maybe she hasn't got the broadest range of an actor or some of it, but she's, I don't know, sultry isn't quite the right word, but there's something about her, again, possibly it's just that she's foreign, but she has got a charm to her and something.
There is a fascination there, yeah.
Yes, yeah. So that works straight away. I'm less like, what is this creep doing? Oh my God. Mm. Because she's much more explicit about being open to the idea quite early on, that she does refuse him initially, but
there is a certain amount of blowing hot and cold, which doesn't get explained just yet. But she does eventually agree to marry him, but with a proviso, basically, he gets to the point. We've been seeing each other for a while. We haven't even kissed. Why not? And. Her concern is perhaps a not entirely conventional concern. Back in her village in the old country, it seems that there were a bunch of witches and evil types who got wiped out by King John of Serbia.
Nice bit of history. It's nicely told as well.
And obviously there were survivors, because there are always survivors. And she fears she may be descended from one of them, and they've got this idea that if they ever allow themselves to feel passion, they will instantly transform into giant evil cats and destroy whatever made them passionate, or whoever, more to the point.
Now, what I like about this is it's all up front, you know, we know kind of what's going to happen, but much as in a lot of werewolf films, you know, tell you outright what's going to. We have the cinematic gypsies in The Wolfman, but here it's told, you know, not over a mysterious fire with like a crystal ball, in a way that you know the film is right and this is what's going to happen. She's just explaining it in a way that it kind of leaves open that, you know, she might just be. You know, have some significant paranoia, some mental disorders, and it's believable that she might be. That, you know, the film really leaves that question open for a long time.
I will say right now, because I think it is one of the things that this film gets absolutely right, is that from that point, right up until the very final scene, it is left ambiguous as to whether she is actually doing this or whether she is just going a bit mad.
Well, I mean, I'm not often moved. I've really felt in my, I've really noticed in our podcast, I'm not often moved by, I don't know if I'm just not very visual person, but by visual splendor sometimes. I just don't really notice cinematography quite often. I'm just quite often in the story and not really, I feel like if I'm noticing, then it takes me out of the story. But here, I don't know, something about it works so well because it is almost film noir in its use of light and shadow.
Mm.
But it is also, one thing it gets absolutely right is what Lovecraft got right in his stories, which is don't show, let the imagination do the work. And so instead of, you know, Lon Chaney loping about in a wood with his, to me, faintly ridiculous wolf costume, we never really explicitly see either a transformation scene or a big cat. It's just so well played with. It's all light and shadow. And as you say, it could be, well, am I just making things up? Was that a thing I saw? And that's what the characters are thinking as well. Mm. So it, as you say, it's never explicitly laid out. I mean, it is in the end, but it's, It's super well done. Well, so the cinematography,
to me, that
just
is ideal. You leave the question open, but you do finally answer it. You don't just leave it dangling at the end. You do resolve the story.
Yes, yes, I absolutely agree.
But in any case, at this point, Oliver, well, a friend of mine once told me in the pub, don't put it in the crazy. And I feel that might have been good advice for him, not that he ever actually gets to put it in the crazy. At the very least, this is clearly a person with problems, but he is a white man, so he can solve any mental problems she might
there
have.
There is a lot of white saviour stuff going on here with him. I like, and his friend, the psychiatrist doctor, is, he marries her, she still refuses to put out because she's worried she'll turn into a wolf.
We have had some minor things, like, the second time he meets her, he brings a cat as a present.
Oh, yeah.
He fell out of sympathy with me. I can see what the film's trying to do, but also, what did they dirt that cat up on that it would go happily into the shoebox and stay there for hours?
Ketamine, probably. with my vet hat on, don't give a pet as a friend. Here is a gift of responsibility for it. Just come on. It's not good for anyone. It's not cool.
But
pets
anyway,
are not presents.
Cats don't like her. They return it to the pet shop. All the pets in the shop go mad at her.
Yes, swap it for a canary.
One feels there might be a refund involved, but anyway. She is playing with the canary and I think it is fair to say accidentally kills it through basically incompetence more than anything else.
But even she isn't sure
whether she did it deliberately or not.
Budgies and canaries can get so stressed with handling that they can die. Mm-hmm. Entirely believable from my perspective. Unfortunately, people don't tend to bring their birds into the vets. Birds don't look unwell until they're really, really unwell, because then they get eaten if they look unwell otherwise. So by the time someone's brought this unhandled bird into the vets that is looking ill, it's already on death's door, and then pulling it out of a cage and looking at it is often a good way to open it for them. Little aside from the veterinary world, but I found that scene entirely believable.
But it turns out she has a convenient box for a canary coffin, which is all sort of thing every flat should come equipped with.
I think that was in the foreground as well. We have a Chekhov's canary coffin. Anyway, yes, she pops it in the coffin.
And carries it around because, I mean, to be fair, whether she is transforming or not, she's clearly a bit thrown by all this.
Yeah, and then she goes and takes it to her friends in the zoo.
Yeah.
Maybe a lesser film would have had her very viscerally munching away through the canary, but she doesn't do that. She hands it to the, is it a panther? Mm-hmm. A big cat, anyway.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, poor old Oliver has kind of lost interest. He's conquered, he's won his love conquest, he's married her, that's fine, he's not going to get any further with her. And
well,
so, naturally,
to be fair, her approach was, I hope things may well get better once we're living together. And this has not happened in however many months it's been.
Yes, and so I've perhaps been a bit mean on him. I mean, understandably, he's now lonely. He's with someone, actually, he's realising, actually, I don't know them all that well. And he confides in his work. And I found this quite a sort of, I just find the acting and the nuances much more interesting here, that he is in this quandary that he's like, well, look, I've made a mistake. I don't quite know what to do. I actually don't really know who I've married. And then this relationship develops with his co-worker. I found it, I mean, yes, it's...
There is room for subtlety of analysis here, which there wasn't in The Wolfman.
Exactly, yes.
I mean, and is this the genuine, I didn't mean to fall in love with you, but I seem to have done it, that the film is apparently portraying it as? Or is she actually just waiting to get her claws into the guy? She just didn't strike fast enough and he met the other woman instead first.
Yes.
Because there's a certain amount of that there, I feel.
Yes, exactly.
The way she's turning her head and the other way she's choosing what to say when.
Yeah, probably. And again, you can sort of, she was enjoying sort of flirting with him and enjoying not to have to sort of commit further. And now she's in a position where, I've lost him. Am I okay with that? It feels human, you know. These are mistakes people make, and these are relationships.
Again, I mean,
we're
she's,
under
she's
the...
not a cackling villain about it, certainly.
No, she's a... yes, you could argue she's an evil sort of manipulator in some ways, but there are multiple ways of reading it, which is nice. We're under the motion picture code, but again, they mention... He feels, this is where we have an awkward moment. So,
well, they do get on with talking about it eventually and he agrees to find a psychiatrist that she can talk to. And she goes to the psychiatrist, played by the excellent Tom Conde, also known as the second Falcon. He replaced George Sanders, his brother, in the role when George Sanders got bored with it. The Falcon is basically a rip-off of the Saint, to the point that Leslie Charteris did actually sue them.
Okay. I thought he was great here because he's sort of professional, but you're kind of watching it thinking, is this a bit, he's actually getting a bit, is he going beyond the bounds of professionalism? And then you wonder, is this just how films are? And is it? But no, it turns out he is actually pushing at the bounds of professionalism. This is his character. Mm. And I like that that is left open a bit, that I was wondering, is this just how all guys are portrayed in these films? But no, it turns out he is actually an awful human being, and he's trying to seduce his patient. But he does it very subtly.
Even that, you could argue that when he does finally kiss her, he's trying for a shock therapy. You know, look, you can be kissed and you won't transform.
And absolutely, that's the excuse he would have used,
yep.
You know, if the husband wants. But yeah, I think he's a great evil villain because he's not really a cackling villain either.
But the trigger point from this is not that, because the first session seems to go reasonably well, and they don't make huge progress, but you wouldn't expect it. But she comes back to the flat. Alice, the other woman, is there, probably innocently.
But it
comes out in conversation that Oliver asked Alice to recommend a psychiatrist, presumably because it's a woman thing, who knows. Our heroine is frankly thrown by this. I mean, you know, you discussed my private shameful thing with this stranger. Or
with
is
this
she
person,
a stranger?
Why don't I? And again, I love it. It's this kind of human love triangle. Yeah, they are all behaving. What I like about it, they're all behaving in a way that is entirely consistent with how humans behave. You know, she's paranoid and lonely. Is she crazy? That's what she's worried about. And then, yes, mental health issues obviously have very different connotations in the 40s. But you're just discussing it with this woman who I don't even know. I really liked the triangle here. And what she, you know, she's inferring there is correct. You know, they do have an inappropriate relationship. That's really good. I mean, I could talk. This film would work really well for me without the giant cat murdering thing.
I mean, this is one of those things. You get some people who talk about, you know, is X or Y really being unfaithful as long as a particular thing didn't happen? And the answer is, if you have to ask... it's being unfaithful.
Yes, yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, and they kind of know that it's inappropriate. And in a way, it's interesting that, what's her name? Alice is kind of brazen about it and almost pretending, whereas Oliver is kind of aware this probably isn't appropriate. And he is decent enough that he wants to sort of do the honourable thing. Once he realizes they genuinely are having, anyway, what she then
for,
goes
for very limited to... values of the honourable thing. I mean, eventually he offers her a divorce, and
or to get committed. There is two.
Well, no, I mean his idea is the divorce.
Yes,
and yeah, that's fine. That's fine for him, but she would then be a divorced woman.
Yeah, exactly. It's
and
not.
She would probably at that point lose her job for that.
Yeah, well, this is why I was surprised we're under the motion picture code, but we're discussing divorce, and we've obviously got a extramarital affair. It is not as explicit, perhaps, as it, and I guess I buy that the characters probably wouldn't have had a sexual liaison, but again, it's left open. Did they? Didn't they?
I don't think so, but yeah.
Probably not, I agree.
There is one lovely moment for me that I think may be entirely accidental. We have Oliver and Alice and the psychiatrist, what's his name?
Dr.
Judd, yes. In a cafe. And she is having, is it Bulgarian cream? Something that sounds vaguely exotic anyway.
Yes.
Dr. Judd is having Roquefort. Guess what Oliver is having? Apple pie.
That was a nice moment as well. We have this incredible...
I did find myself slightly reminded of A Miracle on 34th Street, remembering the guy there. Who turns up to romance our heroine basically because she needs to be romanced because that's what women need.
Well, it's funny when you mention that I'm drawing a complete blank of the guy. That might tell you everything you need to know about him. So we have this incredible. So Simone's character,
Irena,
is then sort of, well, we don't know. We know she knows about it, and then we follow Alice back home. We have
something is following her through the dark,
and it's just beautifully done. The light and shadow. Oh, yeah. Then we have this scene where she's waiting at the bus stop. I mean, this is a very famous cinematic scene, but it's incredible because you get this roar that's exactly like a cat roar, except it's a bus pulling up to her, and it's just beautifully done because it's just oh yeah, obviously it's a bus. That's what it sounds like, but it works so well. And you're kind of expecting her to get ripped to... She's like the dead meat character you're expecting, but no, she's safe. Well, she's not safe, but she doesn't. And then we have a second sort of stalking session in the swimming pool where she is chased.
That, yeah, I mean, take advantage of your available location. That is excellent.
It's beautiful. Again, we don't see anything. We hear things. You see suggestions. Alice isn't sure what she saw. She frightens herself into thinking there's a giant cat there, but no, it's Irena. Oh yeah, how could I possibly? No, don't leave me in a room with her alone. But again, we don't know as an audience quite. I'm again, we're pretty suspicious, but it's just, you don't see a big cat just stalking, padding around the swimming pool. That's just, again, that's a great scene, both of those.
For my taste, and I say this only as an amateur audio production guy, I think they could have done more with the sound there, but quite possibly the techno wasn't up to it to do that.
I agree, yeah. I mean, it's a very specific kind of audible experience in a swimming pool in that kind of room, and it doesn't really kind of live up to that. But that's splitting hairs a bit, because the whole scene works incredibly well.
It's shot beautifully, yeah.
And then we have Irena sort of descending into madness, but we see more scenes with the psychiatrist as he gets more and more kind of, he's like invading a personal space and almost putting his hand on her leg, but not quite. And just, it's so well done.
There is that rather fine bit where she just in, I don't know, desperation, I don't know what to do, is clawing at the sofa and is leaving
the claw marks. Oh, it's so good.
Even though
we
can clearly see it's just her hand with the nails on it, but.
Yeah, this is why I'm less forgiving of the Wolfman, because, you know, we get all these subtleties and interest. We've not even seen, the only big cat we've seen is the panther in the zoo. Mm. But it's just, like, really into the story. You do kind of care about Irena. You care, I guess, a bit less about the other couple, Alice and Oliver, but you do care about them. You're worried about this doctor. It's just, you want to know where the story goes. Where it goes, basically, he's trying to do the right thing and offer her divorce. But the doctor recommends she is committed. That's the kind thing to do. And then he feels like, okay, right, well, the right thing to do now is to have her committed to an asylum because I'm going to look after her. She's my wife. Even though you're not legally allowed to divorce a mental patient in the 40s. So he feels like having her locked up for the rest of her life is the kindest thing to do at this point.
Obviously, in Dark Cat's People, this is the moment which Alice says, aha, I'm going to have to change this. That is not supported by the actual film.
No. Then we're rapidly reaching the conclusion, which is the doctor. What does he do? He's kind of, they're all heading down to go and find her. And he says, oh, I'll just, I've left my coat. And then he goes and unlocks the door, I think.
Yeah.
And so he can get back in. I think he does something. Yeah. It's quite clear he does something nefarious with the door. Mm-hmm. I think he just unlocks it so he can sneak back in the apartment. And then he's waiting for Irena when she comes back, and he's like, incredibly creepy. Again, still just with a veneer of professionalism. That's so well done.
I think what we have to assume here is that either he's actually a pretty rubbish psychiatrist, or he has seriously underestimated just in what state she's in.
I think he just thinks he's a man and he can deal with it because she's a woman. So yes, he probably is a bit nuts, but
it turns out he's wrong.
So he kisses her, and then we discover all along that it turns out she will turn into a giant cat if you kiss her. And
No. That is just hysterical frenzy, to use the term of the era.
Okay. Fair enough.
She has also stolen the panther from the zoo. We saw that happening.
Yes, that might have been involved, but... Anyway, it does not end well for Dr. Judd, who ends up ripped to pieces.
And in the end, she has gone back to the zoo to she hasn't stolen the panther at that point. She's gone back to the zoo to let the panther out.
And the panther...
leaps out, and kills her with one blow.
Yes.
And then probably gets hit by a bus.
Yeah, that was a nice kind of, I don't know, it was well done. It was a good sort of action scene.
But also, of course, we can't show a panther getting hit by a bus. So we will just freeze the pan of the camera there, and then the panther goes out of shot and there is a screech.
Again, that could have been badly done. It's just so well.
Yeah.
It's one of those, a bit like the Psycho thing, you could almost swear you did see the panther getting hit by the bus. Like many people thought they saw the knife going into, Tippi Hedren? Janet Leigh, sorry. One of the other Hitchcock ones.
But also remembering Jaws, of course, that, if you've got the thing that doesn't really work, you have to not show it, but it's more effective not to show it.
I just don't understand why more filmmakers have not cottoned on to the fact that it works better the less you show. Lovecraft knew this before this film was written. Maybe this means it was a box office failure. I mean, it didn't do as well as The Wolfman, but it did pretty well off its budget, I believe. I think the execs didn't like it when they watched it, but
subtlety, and I think, to be fair, it was generally assumed that horror on film was not going to be even slightly subtle. I mean, there was Dracula, and there was the Frankenstein, and there was the Wolfman. There was the Universal to use as the model of what horror on film is. So,
well, so this, I mean, for me, hands down, is a masterpiece. It's cinematographically,
I would argue that apart from the attack on Dr. Judd, which I think is justifiable as herself in a fit of panic, in essence.
You're very much the Dana Scully of this book.
I think it is genuinely a portrayal of mental illness.
You could certainly read it that way. You could also read it as a portrayal of lycanthropy as well. And that's what I like. I agree. We do not get a kind of, here is her turning into a cat. There's lots of hints. But then, even the scene where she scratches open the... it's well enough done that you're like, did I see that? Am I imagining that? Is that just what she thinks has happened? And normally I find that kind of ambiguity a bit annoying. But as you say, it's resolved in the film in a way that it doesn't need to be explicit that she actually turns into a giant cat. What matters is that she believes she does and acts like that.
And I did feel that there was another option here, which is, when she first explains the situation, he could say something like, well, why don't we go to a public place and canoodle? Because let's face it, I'm a white man. I can get away with that sort of thing.
And then if you find
you're losing control, there will be lots of people about, so you can be restrained.
And this is how the New York public massacre occurred, I like your scientific approach to it. I do feel that might not have been, we talked about repressed sexuality. I mean, this is exactly what's going on here. She is repressed and worried that if she releases, then she'll lose control of herself. That's exactly what we're talking about, and it is subtle, but it's much better done What I like, I mean, the thing about nuance and metaphors is that you can read what you like into them and often feel clever and write essays about them and often read more into them than was read, than was written into them. But
yeah,
a bit of that is helpful for a film, just so you can have your own interpretation of it. There aren't many interpretations of the Wolfman other than, and sometimes you don't want that. I don't want to think about the character motivations in Aliens. You know, I don't need to because it's there. But this one is, it just lives by that. And it, for a werewolf story, or sorry, a cat wolf, werecat story, I just think it's brilliant. I loved it. It was really well done.
So we should probably talk about the two, sequels in passing. First one, of course, being 1944's The Curse of the Cat People, which has three of the same characters, four of the same actors, and is completely unconnected in plot.
Okay, perfect. Was it supposed to be connected? And then they
Van Luten, I think, called it Anne and Her Friends or something of that sort. Anne is the kid of Oliver and Alice 6 years later. And he wanted to make it about a child and her imaginary friends, basically. Or are they? During production, or may have been during casting, the studio said, no, Cat People was a huge success. We want to make this a sequel to Cat People. And so they did.
But it really isn't.
I mean, there is no suggestion of whether anybody might be transforming. There is none of that at all, except that Irena's ghost is present briefly.
Okay. All right. I'm not terribly tempted to see that. Was it a different director, presumably?
No.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, I mean, I would certainly be interested to watch more Jacques Tourneur films. I'd like to see it because he's clearly very, very good at what he does. So I'm surprised there aren't other masterpieces on his resume.
It was Gunther von Fritsch and Robert Wise, but it's still Val Luton producing.
So different director, but the same producer.
Many of the same actors.
I mean, on the strength of this, to me, I feel the star of the show is the director here because it's all the cinematographer. It's great. I mean, the acting is good. It's not outstanding, but it's good enough that it works for the film. I would watch more. I might try dabbling in with his, I Walk with a Zombie or whatever, some more of his later horror film.
Probably also mention, at least in passing, the 1982, Cat People.
Yes, I saw this when I was a student, so that was some time ago. and I have very little memory of it at all. I do remember there is much more explicit sex. I think it has Natasha Kinski.
Yep.
And it's just much more overt. That might work in a, you know, this is the opposite of the pinned down repressed. This is the kind of nymphomaniac version of Cat People. I mean, it's not a porn film, but there's not much left.
But it's 80s and we can get away with stuff now.
Well, we will talk about that in another episode.
Well, I think if we just say that when we were looking at 80s werewolves films, we considered this, but there are two others we would rather talk about.
There was a bit of I think we were debating whether there was a bit of a vampire boom in the 80s. It's debatable. I think there probably was, as you say. There was certainly a bit of a werewolf boom in the 80s because, we will talk about that next episode. Let's not remember. But yeah, this one didn't make the grade. I don't remember it being terrible. I just don't remember it being anything at all particularly. So not memorable for me from 25 years ago, if that is any help.
I have not seen it. I remember hearing about it when I came out. So I would have been, 12, 13. Therefore, probably not allowed to see it because it was sex. But as far as I remember it being talked about, it was all about the sex. And, there might be a plot as well.
I think it was much... Well, it certainly was much more explicit visually. This is making me sound like a terrible person. I'll just say that. That's literally what it was. In my memory, it holds no candle to the original. That may be unfair. I haven't watched it recently. I don't feel in a hurry to watch it again, that said. Well, there we are. We will leave the werewolf films for now and return several years later. Well, no, in a few weeks. But cinematographically,
good to go with Moon's Rising.
All right. Until then, beware the moon. Bye. We'll be right back.